Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record and the audio file will be available on our website, CFR.org, if you would like to share it with colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Jason Stearns with us to discuss the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Jason Stearns is director of the U.S. ALMA project at the Rift Valley Institute. Previously, he worked for the International Human Rights Law Group and the United Nations Peacekeeping Operation, Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He was based in Nairobi, Kenya, prior to that as a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. And in 2008, he was appointed coordinator of the UN Group of Experts on the Congo. He's currently working on a PhD in political science at Yale University and is author of the book Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. And we sent out in advance of this call two articles that Jason has published in our magazine, Foreign Affairs, on Congo. So if you haven't had a chance to take a look at those, I hope that you will do so. Jason, thanks very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could begin by giving us an overview of the history of the conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and what you see as the current economic, political, and security situation there and in the region.
Sure, and thank you very much, Irina, for inviting me and to CFR for hosting this call. I'm going to give some broad introductory comments that are purposely broad, and hopefully we can get into the nitty-gritty and more specifics in the Q&A. So the Congo War, for those who aren't familiar with it, has been going on for roughly 17 years, since 1996. The figure that's most often put out in terms of mortality is over 5 million people killed, although that's only for a short period of time. That's from 1998 to 2007. So it's only for nine of those 17 years that we have mortality figures, and those mortality figures are largely related to the humanitarian fallout of the conflict and not actually violent deaths. Currently, the conflict is ongoing. There are 3 million people roughly displaced, mostly in the eastern Congo. There is an offensive that we can get into more in the Q&A session, hopefully, being launched by the Congolese army with support of the UN peacekeeping mission against remaining armed groups in the eastern Congo. So the easiest way of describing the cause and the complexity of the Congolese war is to divide it into three levels: the regional, the national, and the local. On the regional level, the Congo War began was triggered by the Rwandan genocide in 1996, which drove a million people, including the perpetrators of that genocide, across the border into the eastern Congo. Since then, one of the major fault lines of the war in the Congo has been between Rwanda and the Congo. In 1996, the genocide then triggered not only the Rwandan government to invade the eastern Congo to break up those refugee camps, but a coalition of various different African countries invaded the Congo to break up armed groups that were being hosted by the Congolese government on their territory at that time. And so the regional level has really been, the Congo War has never been a civil war. It's always been a regional war, a role with very strong regional involvement. The second level is the national level. The Congo has been run into the ground in terms of state infrastructure, state institutions, since the Belgian colonial period. And in particular under the dictatorship of Mobutu Sese Seko, and that state weakness or the weakness of state institutions, the dysfunction of state institutions has allowed armed groups to proliferate, and that up until today has created serious problems. There are about 50 different armed groups present in the eastern Congo, largely because of this vacuum of state power that exists. And the third level is the local level. And the local level, in particular in the eastern Congo, there are conflicts over land and customary authority that play out along ethnic lines, usually particularly with regards to a large population of people who had immigrated over past centuries from Rwanda, from neighboring Rwanda, and then speak Kinyarwanda. Rwanda, they're often called the Banyarwanda people. And so these local tensions, combined with the regional tensions, have produced an immense amount of violence over the past 17 years. So for a brief chronology, after the Rwandan government and other regional governments invaded the Congo in 1996, to break up those refugee camps, they toppled the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko and installed a president, the father of the current president in power, who then fell out very quickly with his foreign allies, launching a second war in 1998. That then came to an end in 2003 through a peace deal that unified the country, produced a transitional government, and also led to the first elections the Congo had seen in over 30 years, and those elections were held in 2006. The current president, Joseph Kabila, was the winner of those elections, as well as the subsequent elections in 2011. But that peace process, while it unified the country, it unified most of the former belligerents into a national army. It also created new tensions. It basically deeply marginalized one of the strongest belligerents that had been supported by the Rwandan government. It was belligerents that occupied a third of the country. However, at elections, they were reduced to only about 3% representational in national institutions. And that that outcome of the peace process, or that bias in the peace process, produced a new round of escalation in the Eastern Congo, with a new armed group called the CNDP coming to existence between 2004 and 2006 and leading a renewed escalation in the Eastern Congo. So to a certain extent, the peace was made on the back of war during this transition and during this peace process. And a variety of different armed groups proliferated in response to the CNDP, but also in response to a failed army integration and the electoral process that actually saw armed groups become, if you will, instruments or allies for many politicians and businessmen in their search for power. So the logic of armed violence was transformed in this period and became very tied to the political ambitions of various political actors. So the CNDP then, the Congolese government failed in its repeated offensive against the CNDP. Finally, there was a peace deal struck in 2009 that integrated the CNDP into the Congolese army, but that integration failed for various reasons, and then gave birth in 2012 to a new insurrection called the M23, which was really just a successor movement to the CNDP, and in itself also a successor movement to that failed peace process that had so disadvantaged Rwanda and Rwanda's allies in the Eastern Congo. And so it wasn't surprising that the M23 received substantial support throughout its existence from the Rwandan government, and indeed would have probably collapsed had it not been for that support. Late last year, then, the M23 was defeated. It was defeated in November of last year by a combination of diplomatic and military tactics. There was extensive pressure on the Rwandan government to cut support to the M23. There was also substantial documentation of Rwandan support to the M23 during this process, during this period, and a shift, you could say, also in diplomatic relations. The U.S. government in particular, for I think the first time in a substantial way, put a lot of pressure on the Rwandan government. And so the Rwandan government eventually pulled its support from the M23. In addition to that, the U.N. peacekeeping mission also received support from what is called the Force Intervention Brigade. This is a brigade that was established under the UN peacekeeping mission that has a more robust mandate and intervened in a more aggressive and forceful fashion than UN peacekeepers had in the past, and also an improved Congolese army that performed better than it had in the past. So this is sort of where we are today. The M23 was defeated in November of last year, and that has opened up, I would say, a considerable amount of space in the Eastern Congo for, if we are optimistic, broader stabilization, in particular if other regional armed groups, the FDLR, EDF, or Rwandan, Ugandan rebels that are based on Congolese soil, if they can be defeated, then this regional aspect of the conflict that I mentioned at the outset, that was really the driving force behind the conflict through many years, would be significantly decreased, and whereas state weakness and state capacity is going to take many decades to improve, if this regional aspect of the conflict diminishes, then I think there'll be much more chance for a broader stabilization and decrease in terms of the violence, everyday violence in eastern Congo. The other thing that I would highlight just at the end is that this last year and a half has also seen renewed diplomatic activity. For many years after the peace process formally ended, because when the transition ended in 2006, the war was officially declared to be over, even as it continued in the east. For the first time, there has been a recognition that the problems of the Congo are not just technical, but are deeply political. And there is a renewed peace process, if you will, called the Peace, Security, and Cooperation Framework. This is a peace deal that was signed, or a framework deal that was signed between 11 countries in February of 2013. This was basically due to the appearance of the M23 that captured Goma, and to the broader destabilization that was decided by neighboring countries and the Congolese government that something needed to be done to deal with the root causes of the conflict, which they determined to be two: regional meddling in the Congo, if you will, or cross-border destabilization between Congo and neighboring countries, and the fundamental weakness and dysfunction of the Congolese state. And so a reform process was set up to be monitored and overseen by the United Nations to deal with both the regional as well as the national issues in the Congo. Mary Robinson, the former Irish president, was mandated to become the special envoy to oversee this broader process. And various other countries have also appointed special envoys that collaborate with Robinson in this broader framework, including the United States, who nominated former Senator Russ Feingold to become its special envoy for the Great Lakes region. So I think I'll end it there, and there are many different issues that we can get into. I'd be happy to talk, obviously, about any questions or any concerns people have.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Jason, for that terrific overview. Let's open it up now to questions from the students.
At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received, and if at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, you can press star 2. Once again, that's star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Chapman University, Dale Fowler School of Law.
Dean, and a very appreciative of your presentation. I wanted to ask about the premises for Kagame's intervention originally. They were based on large pockets of the former genocidaire, the FAR, the ex-FAR in eastern Congo. And it was always Paul Kagame's premise that he would reserve the right to intervene in eastern Congo as necessary to avoid the potential resurgence of the genocide, or at least support of genocidal elements by the expatriates, now the ex-FAR. So the condition of the ex-FAR is my inquiry. If you could kindly bring me up to date on to what extent the former genocidaire still have a military presence in eastern Congo that might be perceived by Kagame as a threat. And if I could tack on one other quick question, the original incursion was supported by Museveni from Uganda, but in subsequent years a falling out occurred. I wonder if you might inform me of the present status of Kagame and his support for Museveni. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. I think that's an excellent question, and really the presence, this question, the question of the perpetrators of the genocide and their presence in the eastern Congo, has really been at the core of the conflict throughout all of these years. As the caller pointed out, originally this was the trigger for the conflict. The Rwandan government invaded the eastern Congo, backing the Congolese rebellion in 1996 to break up the refugee camps and to target the perpetrators of the genocide in those camps. At that time, the purposes, the ex-FAR, and the ex-FAR had perpetrated the genocide along with various different militias, in particular the Interahamwe. They numbered anywhere between 20 and 40,000 in the refugee camps. Most of the Interahamwe fizzled away. They were not very good soldiers. They were not very valuable. And so when the ex-FAR reconstituted itself in the refugee camps. It was mostly ex-FAR with a lot of new recruits. There was training that was begun. And Kagame's justification, or the Rwandan government's justification for intervening in the Eastern Congo at that time, was a very good one, to the extent that these armed groups continued to launch attacks into northwestern Rwanda in 96 and then throughout 98. Northwestern Rwanda was in a state of insurgency. The Rwandan government then defeated insurgency in its borders in late 1998 and early 1999. Internally, that threat was dealt with, but the ex-FAR maintained bases in the Eastern Congo, and also were supported by the Congolese government throughout this, up until very recently. In fact, whenever the Congolese government has fallen out with Rwanda, it has often sought support from the ex-FAR in its battle against Rwanda and Rwanda's allies in the Eastern Congo. The ex-FAR created a group in 2000. The group was called ALIR, the Army for the Liberation of Rwanda. That group then was transformed and renamed FDLR in 2000. The group has become, it still exists in the Eastern Congo. It has been substantially weakened since 2009. In 2009, the Congo and Rwanda came to an agreement basically to deal with their respective enemies together. So Rwanda cut support to, or at least pushed its former ally in the Eastern Congo to integrate the Congolese army, and the Congolese government then started launching attacks against the FDLR. That offensive was extremely devastating for the local population. It was a very ham-fisted counterinsurgency. So in that 1 year alone, in 2009, a million people were displaced and thousands were killed due to these counterinsurgency operations. But as an effect, also, the FDLR were substantially weakened. And so the FDLR in 2009 were broadly considered to be about 7,000 strong. Today, the estimates range much more between about 1,500 and 2,500. I think the lower estimate is probably more accurate, although it's obviously difficult to know exactly. So the FDLR has been dramatically weakened, is no longer a strategic threat for Rwanda. It can still retain the capacity to launch strikes across the border, but it hasn't launched a major invasion of Rwanda since 2001. So it's been 13 years now since it was able to really significantly destabilize Rwanda. One of the reasons that the next major offensive launched by both the UN and the Congolese army is supposed to tackle the FDLR question. I think that is justified to the extent that the FDLR is a linchpin of instability in the region, but given past military operations and how devastating they've proven, it's also something to be dealt with extreme care. The FDLR will not stand and fight. They run into the forest, and they hold civilians hostage, and they will use civilian abuses against civilians as leverage against the international community. So it's going to be very difficult operations, but I think we were seeing the last years of the FDLR and the ex-FAR in the Eastern Congo. This is a final point. I would say that whereas many people call the FDLR genocidaire, certainly the Rwandan government does, there are very few known genocidaires still within the FDLR leadership. From what we know, at least, there's only a dozen or so who are actually known genocidaires, and not even all of those dozen have arrest warrants on their heads, as far as we know. The Rwandan government has been relatively opaque in proffering this sort of information, but in terms of what is publicly known and documented, very few known genocidaires remain within FDLR leadership, at least.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, ma'am. Our next question comes from Pitzer College.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I have two questions. One is that you seem to emphasize only the regional, the national, and the local. And I was wondering what happened to the international. Because if you go back into history, let's say since 1960, the international has a lot to do with what was happening in Congo. Second question is about the economic dimension. namely that Congo is a country that is very rich in natural resources. And part of it, I think, has to do with access to those natural resources, either by Rwanda or Uganda, and even as far as Zimbabwe, if you remember. So how do you respond to those two questions?
Yeah, thank you very much. This is a key question. Certainly, the international community has been extremely deeply involved. As the caller points out, in the 1960s, the international community, this was in a previous UN operation, in the previous civil conflict in the Congo, the international community was deeply involved and complicit in the assassination of Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba and the secession movement of Katanga. And then basically using the Congo as part of the proxy war against communism in the Soviet Union. This is a drastically different situation today. International complicity exists, but I think it's in a very different form. I think the easiest way of talking about this is talking indeed about the commercial and economic interests of international players, because most often, and even in the Congo, the most often when international complicity is invoked, that it is invoked in terms of economic complicity in trying to raid or extract resources from the Congo, and that war is a means of doing that. In fact, the most read Congolese newspaper, called Le Potentiel, over the last several years, on its front page, had a banner across the front page, at the top of the front page, reading "Non à la Balkanisation," so stop Balkanization in the Congo, and the notion that foreign powers would aspiring to split up the Congo to better further their economic and political interests is extremely widely spread in the Congo and in the region. Now, I don't think that there is much ground for that currently. I don't think that the United States or other superpowers in the world are currently endeavoring to split up the Congo. Now, I say that with several caveats. The U.S. government in the early phase of the conflict was extremely sympathetic towards the Rwandan and Ugandan governments, especially due to the security imperatives that they faced. The Rwandan government, in particular, was facing the threat of rebels in the eastern Congo, including some members of the people of the organization that had perpetrated the genocide. And so there was a lot of sympathy within the Clinton administration in particular, and even after the Clinton administration, towards the Rwandan government, for its own security concerns, and much less, I think, sympathy for the security concerns of the Congolese people, and very not much pressure, at least in those years, for the Rwandan government to hold its own soldiers or allies accountable for the extremely widespread abuses that they were carrying out against the Congolese population. So a complicity in those terms certainly existed during that period. And even beyond that, up until very recently, the U.S. government, members at least of the U.S. government, were sympathetic towards Rwandan claims of involvement in the eastern Congo. Having said that, I think that if during the 1960s the primary crime was a crime of commission, a crime of active complicity or active assassination in the case of Patrice Lumumba in the Congolese crisis, I think now the sin of the international community is apathy and ignorance, largely speaking. There are companies that have profited immensely from minerals, but it's not minerals in the areas occupied by Rwanda or Uganda in the east. These are industrial mines in the southern part of the Congo that had very little to do with the war. And actually, war interrupted exploitation and privatization of these mines and made it very difficult to get them up and running again. And it's only now that the copper and cobalt mines in southern Congo are becoming fully operational again. There we have seen some outrageous shenanigans, if you will, where you have the Congolese government complicit with some international financiers, as well as international mining companies in bringing about the loss of billions of dollars of revenue to the Congolese people through basically a series of fraudulent or flawed mining deals. That has very little to do with, or had very little to do with, the war. There are a lot of minerals in the eastern Congo, but they're almost all exploited artisanally. This means pick and shovel mining. This is tin, it's tantalum, it's gold. Those are the three biggest ones. To a certain degree, it's diamonds, but most of those diamonds are actually relatively far from the conflict zones. Those three minerals, tin, tantalum, and gold, are indeed eventually bought by foreign companies, but those foreign companies have very few links to the armed groups that are involved in taxing the exploitation and transport and trade in those minerals. So there's a complicity in this, to the extent that those foreign companies, up until very recently at least, did little to check and perform due diligence on their supply chains. But I think it would be to get causality wrong to say that those foreign companies that actually brought that about in the first place, that they were arming or that they were funding or fueling the conflict in the first place. They buy goods that have been taxed and tainted by conflict, and they haven't actually, they didn't actually cause the conflict in the first place. There are actually multinational corporations that very much want to get involved in the Eastern Congo in terms of exploitation, industrial exploitation of minerals in the Eastern Congo, but the investment conditions and the conflict itself means that investment doesn't make much sense. So I don't think that one can argue that the conflict in the Eastern Congo was caused by a desire by multinational corporations or superpowers to get at the minerals in the Eastern Congo. I think that there are links. There certainly is complicity. There has certainly been flawed politics and policies in the international arena. We can get more into the specifics of those in further questions. But I think that the sins, the largest sins, by and large, have been sins of apathy, omission, and ignorance, and not sins of active complicity.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, ma'am. Our next question comes from the University of New Mexico.
Thank you very much for your time. I believe that you already addressed some of the questions that we already have. I do want you to elaborate a little bit more, though, on the role that that armed groups play in providing security for multinational enterprises during the extraction. So it may be true that multinationals are not explicitly part of the conflict itself, but it's consumer appetites and it's also massive demand for these minerals, for example, tantalum, that provide the foreground for these armed groups to provide and exploit the communities whereby where around where these resources are extracted. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that armed groups derive a large part of the financing, internal financing, from mining. As I said, there's a lot of mining that goes on in the Eastern Congo. It's largely tantalum, tin, and gold. And all three of those minerals provide funds and finances to various different armed groups in various ways. Almost all of these armed groups are somehow involved in mining in the Eastern Congo. They tax the diggers at the exploitation site. They tax the traders and transporters at roadblocks on their way to the trade hubs. And some of them are involved even in more corporate, in a more corporate fashion, in the sense that they either own the pits or they claim to own the pits in which the digging is done, or they actually have investment in own companies that carry out some of the small-scale trade in the Eastern Congo. So armed groups profit from this. All of the minerals then go to what is called comptoir. These are trading houses. Mostly in the two trade hubs of Goma and Bukavu, and from these comptoirs, they are then traded onto the international market. They go to smelting factories. And largely speaking, Southeast Asia, Malaysia was the biggest one, still is the biggest one, and Indonesia. I say this with some hesitation because the recent the legislation of the Dodd-Frank Act in the United States was the Financial Reform Act, included Section 1502 specifically on the Congo, and that has led many companies to be much more hesitant to buy minerals from the Eastern Congo, in part because they now have duties to report, to provide what is called a conflict minerals report to the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States. And this is for companies that are publicly listed in the United States. And so those companies are much more hesitant because they don't know exactly what their liabilities and risks that they're exposed to by trading in minerals from the Eastern Congo. So the market is in a state of flux. There are various arrangements that are trying to get to grips with this. But to come back to your original question, No, there are no there are very few multinationals actually actively digging in the Eastern Congo industrial exploitation. There's only one that's actually producing anything. It's called Bamero. It's a Canadian-owned company that's active in gold mining in South Kivu. They are not, to anybody's knowledge at least, involved with armed groups. There was some controversy about their contract they initially had, but they're not involved with armed groups. So the companies that are involved with armed groups are involved by 3 or 4 or 5 degrees of separation, to the extent that a company like Intel or Apple will source some of its minerals from the international market, and some of those minerals may come from, or probably do come from, or used to come from before this whole Dodd-Frank situation came about, from the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. It's important to highlight that for the most part, these are small amounts. So in certain tin, the Congo doesn't provide much tin to the international market. It's 3 or 4% of the entire tin production in the world. Gold is similar. What is different, the tantalum is slightly different. The Congo, depending on the year of production, actually does provide about 20% of world's, or has provided at different points in time, about 20% of the world's tantalum production. And in 2000, in particular, there was a bubble in the tantalum market that drove tantalum prices through the roof due to several flukes in the market, including a new issue of I believe it was Nintendo PlayStation. There's definitely complicity. There are definitely multinational corporations that are linked to these local markets. None of these multinational corporations has been found to be directly in complicity with any of these armed groups. There's no document, and there's been, including myself, there's been extensive investigations into this. But many of them have been found to be negligent in terms of how much due diligence they actually carry out in the supply chain. So the question is not that they should know. They should know better. They should be carrying out due diligence, even if those armed groups are 3 or 4 steps removed from them. They need to be held accountable. And this is what the Dodd-Frank Act was about. The controversy surrounding that, and there may be other questions with regards to this, is that the Dodd-Frank Act also de facto basically provoked a boycott of Congolese minerals and led to the loss of livelihoods for many Congolese artisanal miners that are just out there trying to make a buck and who themselves are not involved in armed groups, or at the very least are maybe taxed and abused by armed groups but are not fueling violence in themselves.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Carleton University.
Yeah, thank you, Jason, for your very brief presentation. I have one comment and 3 or 4 questions. The comment is that when you talk about the cause of the conflict at the national level, we have to mention the issue of citizenship of those people called the Banyamulenge, because that's what was the beginning of the insurrection in Uvira in 1996, and that was gave Kagame an alibi to beg them and pursue his goal against the FDLR. So you can remember what happened in Uvira when the Banyamulenge started their own insurrection against the Mobutu regime. So it's very important to mention and analyze this, the issue of citizenship or nationality of Banyamulenge. For many years, they've been given the Zairean citizen and then disenfranchised during the transitional period. The second, the question is, last week, Mr. Kabila indicated in Kinshasa that he's willing to change the constitution. I mean, the goal is to remain in power after 2016. What is your perspective on that? The second question is about President Kagame's refusal to talk to the FDLR. As you may know, they indicated to the UN mission and to the UN that they are willing to go back to Rwanda and stop their fighting or the political struggle, but they are asking for the international community to make pressure on President Kagame so that they can hold a kind of national dialogue. But President Kagame and his government said they can't talk to the FDLR. What is your perspective on that? The third question is also on the conflict in Katanga. I don't know whether you are the question of the issue of the Katanga movement, these militia in southern Katanga, Kalemie, and other districts who are also involved in mass killing and rape, and some of the Congolese or high officials in the military, for example, former General Numbi, the head of the National Police, has been implicated in supporting those people. Do you have any comment on that? And the last question is, you mentioned the issue of the performance of the Congolese army, which they have defeated the M23 last November, and they are pursuing the offensive against the Nalu and other rebel group in eastern Congo in Beni. But why now? Why not? Why not in the past? Thank you.
Well, thank you for all those very insightful questions. Thank you in particular for the first comment on the Banyamulenge citizenship status. I mentioned briefly in my introduction that the local dimension of conflict is extremely important, in particular the status of a large population of so-called Banyarwanda in the eastern Congo and in South Kivu. This population is called Banyamulenge. These are people who at various stages over the last 300-400 years, mostly in the last 100 years, but in some cases it goes back several centuries, immigrated from neighboring countries to the eastern Congo and whose citizenship has been called into question. They also played a prominent role in the war, often participating in Rwandan-backed movements, which only further these doubts about their citizenship. Are they really Congolese or are they Rwandans? This remains an important issue. The citizenship question was sort of solved during the transitional government. There was a new citizenship law was decreed in the constitution. It says that anybody's Congolese who can trace his origins to an ethnic group that was present on national territory in 1960, that's independence. But there's still a lot of ambiguity. That law in itself is relatively ambiguous to a certain extent. The question empirically was sort of solved when the electoral registration process happened in 2005. Anybody who had a national registration card or a voter ID was considered to be a Congolese citizen, and many of the people we call Banyamulenge or Banyarwanda obtained those cards. Another thing that has sort of decreased slightly, at least, the salience of that issue is the participation of many Banyamulenge in the offensive against the M23 that was a Rwandan-backed movement last year. The Congolese army, many Banyamulenge within the Congolese army participated against this group, which sort of earned them, in the eyes of many Congolese, the credentials of being patriots and not actually being proxies for Rwanda. So this is an issue that, to a certain level, has been addressed, but it's never been addressed through national public debate. There is still an enormous amount of anti-Rwandan sentiments prevalent in the eastern Congo or throughout the Congo, and during election campaigns in particular, there is quite a bit of discrimination that comes up. So the crimes of all these various communities and the scars of the past really haven't been dealt with. Transitional justice only received extremely short shrift in the Congo, so that's an important issue. I won't get into all the other questions that you have, but let me just pick one or two because they're very good questions and very topical. The issue of national reforms and Kabila's own personal future. So most of the international attention has focused on the East and the conflict in the East, but for many Congolese, the question is really about the national government and creating a state that is really able to protect the people and not predate upon the people. A state that would provide them services and not just extract resources from them. And that is an ongoing battle. The Congolese state is extremely dysfunctional up until today. It has a very small economy and is extremely patrimonial to the extent that many officials in the Congo deal with public office as a private resource. Joseph Kabila has been now in power since 2001, so he's been in power for 13 years. He is term limited. He will not be, according to the Article 220 of the Constitution, cannot stay on past 2016. And yet there is no obvious successor, and obviously many people around him, and perhaps Kabila himself, would like to stay on past 2016. There hasn't been a clear stance on this. The Kabila's allies, including the information minister, has said that he will not stand for elections in 2016, that he will abide by the Constitution. But there have been many other people in his presidential majority that have contradicted that. And Kabila himself has not exactly been extremely clear. He hasn't pronounced himself directly or very clearly on this particular issue. So there's a lot of speculation, and I don't really think that we know what's going to happen. But I would just say that this next round of the first round of elections in 2006 went very well. The next round of elections in 2011 was widely seen as rigged and flawed. And so the 2016 elections will be crucial, not just in terms of who becomes president, but in terms of the consolidation of the democratic process, which is extremely chaotic, which is extremely corrupt in many ways, but has really created a system that, for all of its flaws, it's not a Jeffersonian democracy, but it's a system that actually holds its leaders or limits the power of leaders. So it's difficult for Kabila. Kabila's bound to parliament, and he's bound to a political process and elections to make it difficult for him to carry out too many abuses. So I think it's very important to put an emphasis on that constitutional process, and in particular the 2016 elections. And especially the U.S. Special Envoy, Russ Feingold, has really laid that out as his own priority, and I think correctly so. In terms of other issues, mentioned the FTLR negotiations with the Iranian government. I find that's going to be extremely difficult. The whole identity of the Iranian government is wrapped up in the genocide. Genocide permeates every part of discourse in Rwanda. I really don't think, I think Rwanda, the Iranian government, the RPF party that's been in government pretty much since 1994, would rather see itself basically exiled to the North Pole than negotiate with his arch enemies. Then it all would be difficult from a diplomatic point of view to push that too far. The FDR do include members who are considered to be war criminals, and it's an abusive criminal organization that carry out a lot of abuses in Eastern Congo. So I don't think that it is. I don't think that political liberalization in Rwanda, which is, I think, an imperative, should be linked to negotiations with the FDLR. And so I think that some of the alliances that political opponents have crafted in Rwanda with the FDLR have been unfortunate, and they should have linked their future to the FDLR. On the Katakatanga issue, this is, I'm probably going to skip over this. I would just mention that whereas there have been some members of the Congolese political elite who have been cited in allegiance with the Katakatanga, there's a lot of things to dispute that. So I'm not personally sure whether people like General John Mumbi and others are really behind this group. It's possible, but I think that the jury is still out on that issue. And the Congolese, with regards to the Congolese army's offensive in Eastern Congo, I think that up until now, the main priority of the Congolese army was dealing with the M23. It's only because the M23 was defeated that they now see that they have space and the opportunity to deal with these other groups. But I think there's a lot we don't know about these operations. The Congolese army has declared victory against the ADF Nalu, for example, this Ugandan rebel group. But most independent sources sort of suggest that the ADF Nalu is alive and well. They've lost troops. They've lost territory. But the battle is far from over. So I think the Congolese army is currently in a phase of trying to find itself. It is still extremely corrupt, nepotistic. There are many competent officers within the Congolese army, but they operate within an extremely dysfunctional framework.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Bush School at Texas A&M.
You could talk a little bit about the differential approach that you think would be appropriate for the various armed groups in the Kivus, in particular the ADF or the FDLR, or even the Mai Mai groups, who some might say might be approached through economic development means as a viable approach to helping them disarm. And then, in addition, what role does economic development in general play in the region?
Yeah, thank you. I think each group needs to be treated on its own merits or dismerits, I guess, depending on how you see it. I think that the military option, which is pretty much the only option on the table with regards to the FDLR, has proven to be extremely nefarious for the local population. So as I mentioned before, in 2009, operations against the FDLR were, at the end of the day, relatively effective, but only after displacing a million people, probably killing thousands, certainly causing the rapes of thousands of women. I personally don't think that any sort of offensive, regardless of its outcome, is justified if it has that sort of side effect. So I think that the military option should be treated with much more caution than it currently is. It's been treated in a very cavalier fashion, that this is finally have a UN peacekeeping mission that's willing to be more robust, finally have a Congolese army that's willing to take stronger action, with not much care about precedent that has been set with regards to these kinds of operations. So I think that wherever there are peaceful avenues, they should be exploited. The FDLR, it's difficult given the status of its commanders. Many are seen as war criminals. Its supreme commander, General Mulatsumura is on a UN sanctions list. Is considered as a genocide there by the Rwandan government. So I think one option that needs to be put on the table has been discussed, or it's currently being discussed in diplomatic circles, is something called the third country of exile for senior and mid-ranking commanders. This would involve, could involve, for example, commanders who are not known war criminals, who do not have known abuses on their records, be allowed to go into safe exile into a third country. It could be another African country, for example. That would have to be negotiated. It would not be easy. It's difficult to find countries that would be willing to take them, but anything is pretty much better than this extremely extremely abusive conflict that's ongoing in the Eastern Congo. The ADF is a somewhat different situation. There is also a demobilization program in Uganda. There's some outreach in Uganda, but the group is different. It's there's many Congolese who are involved in the group. There are some Tablik Islamists who are increasingly influential within the leadership of the group. There have been some contacts between ADF Nalu and other Islamist organizations in Africa, including allegedly Shabab in Somalia. So it's an organization that has to be dealt with differently, but in a very similar way to the FDLR. This is a group that is very willing to hold the local population hostage and use civilian damage, collateral damage, as a form of leverage against the international community. So I don't think either group would be very easily tackled through diplomatic negotiations with its leadership, although that hasn't been tried with ADF Nalu. But I think that there are, even outside of that, there are peaceful or political avenues that are open that have not been exploited yet and that need to be exploited. With regards to the FDLR, I think we also need to point out that this is a group that, in theory, should be on its last legs. It's extremely weakened because of its experience in the last couple of years. With regards to economic development, I think that this is particularly useful for groups that that are driven by grassroots demands and grassroots constituencies. Some Mai groups qualify as that. Other groups are actually not. I mean, one of the dynamics over the last years in the Congo is that armed groups have increasingly become dislocated from the grassroots out of which they originated. There is a sort of military bourgeoisie that's involved in Eastern Congo, with many of these armed groups, including Mai groups, becoming very tightly linked to politicians, to business networks. They are perceived by their local constituents, their local peasants, as abusive and not representing them. So for those groups, for the ones that are dislocated from the local communities, economic development, these would not immediately target their demands. What they want is they want to use their military power for bargaining, to get political power, to get positions, to get wealth. For those groups, I think we need a different approach. There needs to be sanctions against the politicians, the Congolese politicians in particular, who are very well known. And they need to be arrested, they need to be sanctioned. Those support networks need to be clamped down on. And those groups are mostly speaking groups of 100, 200 people. Targeted military operations against the commanders also can be effective. To the extent that insurgency is being fueled by local dynamics at the local level, by conflicts over land and customary authority, that's definitely a factor. That should be addressed as well through a long-term economic development plan. The problem with those plans in the past has been that they've received extremely little buy-in from the Congolese government. Economic development is an inherently political task and challenge. It needs buy-in from political leaders to be able to channel, to funnel, to manage the funds in a sustainable fashion. The experience we've had in the Eastern Congo has been the so-called STAREC program, which is a program of local rebuilding and economic development that took place between 2010 and 2012, I believe. The program was funded to the tune of $250 million by the international community. The Congolese government was supposed to pony up its own share. It really didn't. It spent a laughable amount, I believe less than $1 million, on STAREC funds. Many of the police stations that were built went unstaffed. There were local administrators deployed, but they didn't have any funds. They didn't have a cell phone. They didn't have fuel for their motorcycle. And so STAREC was really an example of how economic development really also requires political buy-in. I think that's really the challenge. At the moment, there are negotiations underway between donors and the Congolese government to try to somehow figure out how to come to a common agreement about doing that. But it really butts up against the political rationale of the government that cares relatively little about economic development and much more about political survival, and sees these sorts of attempts as more economic opportunities to siphon off funds for the political campaigns and fortunes of the elites, rather than actually developing their society at a grassroots level.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, our next question comes from Drury University.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Oh, okay. Hi, I was just wondering, and you touched on this in your previous question, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the issue of sexual violence and how that's being addressed by some of the people there on the ground.
Right. This is an extremely important issue, I think also a controversial issue, several, and I won't be able to fully deal with it, but a couple of thoughts. First of all, there's no doubt that sexual violence is a feature, an extremely unfortunate, tragic feature of this conflict. By best estimates, at least hundreds of thousands of women have suffered from sexual violence in the Eastern Congo. And there is signs that it is not abating, that in fact it's becoming also a feature of civilian life as well, that a lot of the rapes, abuses that have taken place are carried out by civilians as well as armed groups. And so it's a serious problem. There has been, I think, a somewhat superficial treatment of this in the media. It's very often the common belief is that sexual violence is used by armed groups as a weapon of war. I think that is sometimes the case, to the extent that armed groups want to use sexual violence to intimidate the population, to extract resources from the population, to prevent the population from snitching on them, from writing them out to the government, et cetera, to terrorize the population. In other words, that is certainly the case in some areas. In other areas, it's true that the armed groups use sexual violence not as a way to terrorize the population, but to indoctrinate their own followers and their own soldiers. They will, as gangs around the world do, they force their soldiers to rape and carry in public so that they would separate them from the community out of which they come, and so on. And in some cases, sexual violence has become opportunistic in the sense that it's not driven by an overall instrumental objective, but that soldiers in this chauvinistic environment rape because they can. And because they aren't punished, and because they feel empowered by doing so, or for whatever the reasons, it's not necessarily linked also to some overall objective that the armed group has. There have been different ways of tackling this problem. It's become obviously an issue of international concern. Oprah has talked about this. Eve Ensler in the Vagina Monologue has talked about this. Ben Affleck. There's been a lot of celebrities involved in this. I think that the concerns are that there have been some initiatives that have been launched that have addressed this issue successfully, including mobile courts. These are courts, Congolese courts, that are funded by donors, that are given money, that are given fuel for the cars, are given vehicles, are given the judges and prosecutors are often paid through international donor money. But these are Congolese judges and lawyers that go out into rural areas that hold mobile courts and that try, often Congolese military officers. They've been very successful in terms of prosecuting officers, mostly at a junior level. They've been less successful at the senior level, but they've been relatively successful. The problem is that, in order really to have an impact, I think there needs to be a recognition of command responsibility. In other words, commanders, even if they themselves do not rape, need to be made responsible or held accountable for the behavior of their own soldiers. That really hasn't Not many of the prosecutions have been, I think none of them have really been carried out along those lines, with the possible exception of one. And the second problem is that these initiatives are not sustainable. As soon as the donor funding stops, they stop. And this in general has been a problem of donor-sponsored initiatives in the Eastern Congo, as I pointed out before, is that very often if they're not built on political will, or political ownership by the Congolese state or local actors, that they stop as soon as the funding stops. And this is another problem. So I think that whereas a lot of money has gone to rape hospitals or hospitals that deal with rape survivors and fistula surgery and other things that is certainly welcome, most Congolese civil society activists, women activists that I speak with say, we don't need more hospitals, we need the rapes to stop. that will only come with an efficient way of sanctioning, finding the perpetrators and sanctioning them and preventing them from happening again. And there, I think progress has been much more limited.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, our next question comes from San Diego State University.
Hello. You did a fairly good job of answering what my question would have been, but I'm wondering how the FDLR will be able to be disrupted without a wide series of rape and killings that could ensue and displacing people.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned that before. I don't think they will. And I think this is why we need to consider very carefully what the other options on the table are, including politically difficult options, such as talking to the FDLR leadership and trying to get them out of the country to go elsewhere. I think there's an awful lot that can be done short of engaging in an official political dialogue that would empower and recognize the FDLR as a political actor. And everything needs to be done, I think, in order to prevent more killings. Very often, the political strategy of dealing with armed groups in Eastern Congo does not take into consideration the humanitarian fallout. So that needs to happen. I think that there are some positive signs on that in that regard. I think some governments that are involved are open to considering options. But we'll have to see what happens. This is going to pan out in the next 4 to 5 months. So I think that the higher profile this issue and the more pushback we can get with regards to the dangers of military action, the better.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, our next question comes from Syracuse University.
Thank you. Connie Freeman, Maxwell School, Syracuse University. First, let me say how much I have enjoyed reading all of the materials that you have produced, in particular your book, which I do use for my class. My question relates to an old issue on Congo, and that comes down to, is Congo actually governable in its current configuration? It's very large. It has limited communications. It has districts and provinces and areas that are very different from each other. Would it not make sense for a greater degree of federalism at a minimum to be instituted by the Congolese government in order to facilitate this? I think there are political factors that mitigate against it, but that the idea perhaps should be promoted. Can you comment?
Yes, thank you very much. And thank you for using my book, obviously, in your class. I think that this is a very important question. There have been commentators, including people like Peter Pham, Jeffrey Herbst, writing opinion articles in Foreign Policy magazine and the New York Times, calling for the Congo to be broken up, basically. I think it's important to note that these are almost always voices from the outside. Very, very, very few Congolese would agree with that position. Almost all of the recent wars, this is in contrast to the wars in the 1960s in the Congo, almost all of the recent wars since 1996 have been waged by armed groups that do not have any separatist agendas. None of these armed groups, as much as they've had complaints or grievances, has listed amongst those complaints and grievances secession. So one of the things, Mobutu, who ruled the Congo, misruled the Congo for 32 years, did many things wrong. But over that time and in previous time, a sense of national identity has been forged and was forged. The Congolese are extremely patriotic, and it's difficult to find people, even in the East, who agree with the notion of splitting up the country. Now, they certainly don't have any love lost for the government or for the state that they perceive to be extremely abusive, but I don't think they see the solution to that as secession. One of the reasons for that is that for many people, especially in the East, where the bulk of the violence takes place, see secession as a euphemism for annexation by a neighboring country. So if some people would say break off the Eastern Congo, it has wealth, it's more connected to East Africa than it is to the West, and so on. many people in Eastern Congo would see that as just a euphemism for being annexed by Rwanda, by Uganda, and would deeply object to that for that reason. So I think that the first imperative is that the Congolese have decided for themselves. They have there was an extensive constitutional process in 2005. There was a constitution was put up for referendum, was drafted and put up for referendum. It was approved by overwhelming majority of Congolese. I think in subsequent polling, most Congolese approve of having a unified country. Very, very few would accept secession. But the problem, I think you would also agree with you saying that there needs to be greater decentralization of power. Now, the current constitution calls for that. It calls for a strongly decentralized system where 40% of the national wealth should be managed by provinces. And 40% of the provincial wealth should be managed by, should be retroceded, should be given back to local levels for administration. Now, that hasn't happened. And not only has that not happened, a lot of the political reforms that need to take place for that to be effective have also not happened, including local elections that have been continuously postponed. Local elections have never happened. And so, in theory, the theory behind the Constitution is that government needs to be brought closer to the people, and the management of resources needs to be brought closer to the people instead of being exploited by a very small and narrow and corrupt elite based in Kinshasa. And that has not taken effect. So I think the response to your question, your query, would be that there is a blueprint for how to deal with power in the Congo, and the blueprint is the Constitution. Unfortunately, it's been abused and neglected by the government. But that if there is a way of going forward, I think that most Congolese would say that is the way to go forward. Let's have these local elections, let's decentralize greater power as well as money, and let's have the people become closer to the people who govern them. And that's probably, I'm certainly not, that's not a panacea, and there's all kinds of problems involved with that as well. But I think that they would agree with that much more than they would agree with either secession or even federalism.
Jason, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today. I regret that we are out of time, and I apologize to all those that of you who had questions, and we just couldn't get to you. But it has really been a terrific hour, so thank you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I hope that all of you will again look at Jason's work in foreign affairs and take – I commend his book to you, as Connie Freeman mentioned. We also are offering a special subscription rate to foreign affairs for students and professors of 1995, if you want to take advantage of that. Our next call will be on Wednesday, April 9th. Seth Jones, Associate Director of the RAND Corporation, will discuss Afghanistan after the drawdown. So I hope that you will join us. We will be sending out a formal invitation for that call. So thank you again for today's participation, and look forward to reconvening on April 9th.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.